A year of college tuition can cost anywhere from $4,000 to $40,000. For most of us, shelling out that money is a stretch. For low-income families, it's often an impossibility. Back in 1965, Congress approved the Higher Education Act. It was intended to make college affordable for everybody. 40 years later, for many Americans, that seems like a distant dream. Some universities have programs of their own. Well-endowed Harvard, for example, has long subsidized the tuition of students from poor families. And last month, President Larry Summers announced that Harvard will do even more. Even so, the great majority of the student body at elite colleges comes from wealthier backgrounds. Summers and other educators say that economic diversity is as important as racial diversity. Some argue that we need to refocus on a new kind of affirmative action based on class. Later in the program, greed is the latest in our series on the seven deadly sins. Author Phyllis Tickle joins us. But first, a look at what it's like for low-income students to get into college and what happens once they get there. If you made it to or through college with little money, give us a phone call. Our number here is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Richard Collenberg, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation in Washington, D.C., author of America's Untapped Resource, Low-Income Students in Higher Education. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
As we mentioned, in 1965, the Higher Education Act was supposed to make college affordable for everybody. How are we doing?
Well, since 1965, we've seen an increase in the number of low-income students who are attending college, but we've also seen a large increase in the number of middle-class and affluent students. So, and the gap between the going rates of low-income students and more affluent students remains about as large as it was in 1965.
And let's get some definitions straight. How are we defining poor in this context?
Well, the standard definition in higher education is to say those who are eligible for Pell Grants are low income. And so that would be roughly those earning below $40,000 a year.
And of those who fit into that category, how many go on to a four-year college?
Oh, well, the numbers are very low, and particularly at the selective colleges. If you look, for example, at the quartile breakdown by economic status, at the 146 most selective universities, we have a 3% representation from the low-income students and a 74% representation from the most affluent quartile. So in other words, you're about 25 times as likely to run into a rich student as a poor student on the nation's elite campuses.
And again, those are selective elite colleges. Is the problem there alone?
No, it's not. I mean, more broadly, if you look at four-year colleges generally, about two-thirds of those from the top economic quartile go on to a four-year college. In the bottom economic quartile, it's about one-fifth. So there's a gap among four-year colleges generally. It's particularly acute at the selective colleges.
Okay. How much aid is there to be had for poor students? You mentioned Pell Grants. More or less now than earlier?
Well, there's more aid available, but it goes less far. The problem is that tuition has increased at a higher rate than the increases in the Pell Grants. And so, for example, in the mid-1970s, the maximum Pell Grant covered about 40% of the total cost of going to a private four-year college. Today, it covers only about 15%.
Any plans to start addressing that gap?
Well, unfortunately, the Bush administration hasn't even offered a bill yet to reauthorize the Higher Education Act, which is due to expire this year. We haven't seen much action in Congress either. But it really is encouraging what a few of these presidents of universities are doing. Larry Summers' initiative to address economic diversity at Harvard, I think, is very welcome. Anthony Marks, who's the new president of Amherst, is also looking at economic diversity. We made a lot of progress on the racial front, addressing diversity by race at these colleges, but the dirty little secret of higher education has been that We haven't addressed economic diversity. So it's encouraging that we're seeing some movement on this now.
And given the situation that we have today, what's the outlook for students from poorer families?
Well, the outlook is not good in the short term. We have, on the federal level, enormous deficits, and so the prospect of seeing large increases in the Pell Grant, which are really required, are unlikely. But these initiatives from individual colleges, I think, are quite encouraging. A few years ago, Derek Bach, the former president of Harvard, wrote a book which endorsed race-based affirmative action, but basically said poor students won't be able to survive at elite universities. And now you have President Summers essentially repudiating Derek Bach's position on that. And the other development is we've seen William Bowen, the former president of Princeton, come out with a plan endorsing economic affirmative action. And he, along with Bach, had previously said that this wasn't possible. So we're seeing a shift in the tide here, and I think that's very helpful.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Richard Kahlenberg, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation in Washington, D.C., author of America's Untapped Resource, Low-Income Students in Higher Education. He joined us here in Studio 3A. This weekend in the New York Times Magazine, Walter Ben Michael's opinions on this question were featured in an essay. He's the head of the English Department at the University of Illinois Chicago, and he joins us from NPR's Bureau in Chicago. And it's nice of you to be with us here on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You made a comparison in your essay that we need economic affirmative action, if not more than we needed racial affirmative action. Why do you think so?
Well, you know, I come at this from a standpoint of someone who's long been a supporter of race-based affirmative action, but I think it's become obvious in the past few years that race-based affirmative action, traditional affirmative action, hasn't made much of a contribution to undoing the fundamental economic inequalities of American life. And I think that, in fact, it's actually inhibited the effort to deal with those inequalities. I mean, it hasn't made a contribution because most of the minority students it brings to elite universities come from middle and upper middle class families. And I think it's actually harmful because it presents what I think is a false vision of equality. It tells us that our universities are fundamentally fair if they're appropriately diverse, which is to say if the middle and upper middle classes are represented in all the appropriate skin tones. So, you know, all the upper middle class white kids look around campus and see a more or less disproportionate number of upper middle class black kids, and of course, or rather a more or less proportionate number, mm-hmm. and a disproportionate number of Asian kids, and they congratulate themselves on having succeeded on their merits, not on their race. And they're right. It's not their race. It's their money, their parents' financial and social capital that has given them a crucial advantage. So the real victims are not black kids or Asian kids, but poor kids, many of whom, of course, are black and Asian and Latino.
And of course, as mentioned earlier, it does speak to some levels of progress that at least there is racial diversity in many places, but not at class diversity.
Well, I guess, you know, it does speak to some level of progress. And there's no question that racial diversity is a good thing, but you have to sort of wonder about the structure of one's commitment when one's thinking, well, what's important to us is to have lots of upper middle class kids, but to have them all in the right races. You know, it seems to me more fundamental to say we need to stop thinking of our universities and stop creating a context in which our universities are essentially, especially the elite ones, the 146 most selective ones that the previous guest mentioned, stop thinking of those universities as repositories for the upper middle class. As it stands now, we really have a university system where it's not just a university system, in fact, it's more fundamentally an educational system which takes kids and acknowledges whatever their class position is when they enter kindergarten and then reproduces that class position for them at the end of the 12, 14, 16, or 18 years they spend going to school. So you don't really want an educational system which is nothing but a tracking device for inequality in American society.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. And well, let's talk with Lewis, who is with us from Sacramento, California.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, the affirmative action, race-based, or it being economically based, do we know, are there studies there to show the percentage of, let's say, for example, Hispanic students in the Southwest from middle-class families, are they more apt to you know, be accepted in the universities? Is the funding there? And what's the retention rate? Do we know what the retention rate is of students of that nature?
Walter Ben Michaels?
I don't know this Southwest, but the general, the general rate of acceptance for minority students in the middle and upper middle class is very high. That is, if you look at the kids we have, in fact, brought onto campus in the last 10 or 15 years from African-American and Hispanic families, they tend to be ranked mainly in the upper middle class and often in the middle class. I think the statistics from Bowen and Bach is something like 86% of them are from middle class or upper middle class families. So there's a certain moment in American institutional life now where upper middle class black kids and upper middle class Latino kids are doing better. But that, of course, doesn't address what I'm suggesting is the fundamental problem, which is poor kids, whether they're Latino, black, or white.
Mm-hmm. Lewis, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Martha, and Martha's joining us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My mother was on aid to dependent children because my dad died when I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
And in my world, which was middle class, we were slipping into poverty. And I certainly didn't have expectations coming from my world, and this was in the 60s, that I was going to be able to go to college. I was able to get some scholarships to a private Catholic women's college in my city, and I also worked. And I was able to come out of college without a great deal of debt load. I find that my son, who's now in law school, was only able to go there because he borrowed a huge amount of money and was looking at a huge amount of debt. And I know that if I, coming from my class background, had had to look at a great deal of debt coming out of college, that level of debt, there's no way that I would have been able to get an education and I would have been able to go on and raise my own lifestyle and my own standards. And I'm very concerned about the fact that it's not only the fact that is the money available to these schools, and because, as I say, I was right on the cusp of being middle class and in poverty, and whether there's going to be the possibility for people to not have to face the terrific burdens that these loans, if you can even get them, if you can even qualify for them, place upon the young people now.
Walter Ben Michaels, is it about the money?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to make light of your problems, but of course, if your son's going to be a lawyer, we may make a lot of that money back fairly quickly.
Yes,
and in fact,
I think
things
will. But a lot of people, if they want to go into the arts, which I did, you're not looking at making a lot of money back.
No, that's right. And I think that actually the situation is worse now than it was 30 years ago, not just because of the increased costs, but also because there's been a tremendous movement in the country to begin shifting the very basis of scholarship aid. So the extraordinary popularity of so-called merit-based scholarships and the tendency to replace need-based scholarships with merit-based scholarships has meant that you have now have students, colleges, using the kind of money they devote to scholarship aid to recruit the best and brightest of the middle class and the upper middle class, rather than reaching out to people precisely who have a kind of economic disadvantage.
The fundamental, and I know this from having worked in the arts and being around wealthy people a great deal, and coming from my background, that was a real stretch for me sociologically. What I know is that there is very commonly a prejudice against people who are poor or people who are on the edge of being poor, as we were. The assumption is you're like that because you're inferior. You're inferior intellectually.
Yeah.
And you're inferior because, you know, your forebears weren't able to pull you up by your bootstraps into a higher level of economic prosperity. And there really is this cultural bias, assuming that poor people are poor because they're inferior in some way. And I've seen it consistently in my own social interactions with people from other classes. And I think that that's an underlying theme that people are very uncomfortable with and don't want to look at.
Martha, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. We're going to continue our conversation after a short break. Again, if you'd like to join us, it's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can email us, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing college and low-income students, what it takes for them to get there and how they fare once they arrive, both financially and culturally. In a few minutes, we'll be welcoming the president of Columbia University's Teachers College. But right now, Walter Ben Michaels of the University of Chicago, University of Illinois at Chicago is on the line with us. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. Walter Ben Michaels wrote an essay in last Sunday's edition of the New York Times Sunday Magazine. And I'd like to get you to elaborate on a bit you wrote about it. The reason we like the problem of racism, you wrote, is that solving it just requires us to give up our prejudices, whereas solving the problem of economic inequality might require something more. It might require us to give up our money. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's funny. The last caller said something about prejudice against poor people. And much of the discussion has revolved around a concept of economic diversity. And I think it's really important for us not to make the mistake of starting to think about this problem as if it were a new form of a diversity issue. The problem of racism is the problem of prejudice, both personal, social, and institutional. And the way to solve that problem, ways we've attempted and in part succeeded in, is by giving up those prejudices. But the problem of economic inequality is not a problem of prejudice. The fundamental problem with being poor is not that people don't respect you, although that may well turn out to be a consequence. But the fundamental problem of being poor is that you don't have enough money. And I think one of the things we have to begin to think about if we're thinking about this issue is what it means to redistribute a certain amount of the wealth in this country. And there's an important sense in which that redistribution, one of the most plausible places for it to take place, is in the educational system. You know, it's my fundamental, you know, sort of intuitions about this come from simply comparing the kind of school that I was fortunate enough to be able to send my son to, a kind of very upper middle class private school in Baltimore, Maryland, to the kind of school that most people are not able to send their children to, and that is increasingly poor, increasingly underfunded, both rural and urban public schools. It's obvious that the kids in the kind of school my son went to get a real head start. They are, in the famous phrase, if not born on third, born on second, whereas the kids in the other schools don't have that opportunity. And we aren't beginning to think about what it would mean to create a just society until we begin to think about what it would mean to give those children that opportunity.
Joining us now is Greg Forster, a senior research associate with the Manhattan Institute. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Should we implement some sort of affirmative action policy for economically disadvantaged students?
Well, there's one problem that has to be faced when we look at that, and that is that there is not a large population of students who are academically able to go to college who don't go for financial reasons or any other reasons. We took a look at data collected by the U.S. Department of Education. They collect a huge amount of data on America's students, and we wanted to find out how many students have even the minimum qualifications to apply to college. You have to have a high school diploma. You have to have certain courses on your high school transcript. You have to have taken 4 years of English and a certain number of years of math and science and so on. And you have to be literate. You have to have basic reading skills. And if you don't have those qualifications, colleges won't even look at your application. So it isn't a matter of should we give this student a little bit of an advantage over this student or anything like that. These are qualifications you need to have before you can even apply.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
What we found out of about 4 million 18-year-olds in the year 2000, we found that about 1.3 million have the academic qualifications necessary to apply to four-year colleges. And that's, we looked at the lowest level of prestige and the lowest level of selectivity for four-year colleges and in order to determine what was necessary to get in. And we looked in the same year how many students actually started college in that year. And what we found was that it was about the same number. It was 1.34 million. So it's almost exactly the same number of kids. So although there may be some kids out there who are academically qualified to go to college but are prevented from going for other reasons, that is not a large number of students. The main problem is that kids are not academically ready.
And doesn't that suggest that the problem is not necessarily, or not the entire problem is certainly not at the college level, but maybe at the secondary education level and even before?
And even before the secondary. It's the K to 12 education system is not producing a sufficient number of students who are qualified academically to even get in the door and be considered to go to college. And I should say that we broke the data down by race because the data were available in that format, and we found the same results for all of the racial groups that we were able to look at. We looked at whites, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, and American Indians, and we found in each case that the number of kids who were college-ready academically was almost the same as the number of people who started college in that year.
Walter Ben Michaels, I heard you nodding in agreement there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that what's just been said is absolutely right, and it makes the point. I mean, even if we were to institute, that's why President Summers' efforts, although well-intentioned and well-meaning, are deeply, deeply beside the point. The problem is not all those kids out there who, if they could just put together the money, and I acknowledge it's a lot of money to get through Harvard, would go to Harvard. The problem is all those kids out there who were never remotely close to being in a position to apply to a place like Harvard, or even for that matter to a less selective institution like my own, UIC. So I think there's a way in which, if we really end up focusing this discussion about American education on economic affirmative action, while at least start us looking at the right set of problems, economic inequality, it cannot be the solution. The solution has to start much, much earlier, and that solution has to go to some more fundamental facts about American life, which is that over the last 30 years, it's become increasingly unequal. Mm-hmm. And as we know, the gaps in American wealth have grown greater.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Virginia, who's with us from Littleton, Colorado.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I come at this issue from two angles. My parents were both college graduates, but we had very little money growing up. My parents gave me not one cent to go to college or to law school. And yet here I am paying full tuition for my own 19-year-old at the University of Southern California. And I guess my concern is that I am hoping that the funding for any economic affirmative action shouldn't come from tuition hikes from people who are struggling like I am, driving my 17-year-old Volvo wagon, making other kinds of sacrifices, which I'm happy to make. But I'm not sure that I can afford to subsidize the economic affirmative action that some people are proposing today.
Yeah, Greg Forster, Harvard, as we mentioned before, has a huge endowment. They can afford to do this.
Well, the problem is not what we can afford. The problem is that there aren't kids out there who can be brought into the system. As long as you only have about a third of all students who are academically able even to apply, then providing additional financial aid or additional affirmative action of any kind, all you're going to end up doing is shuffling the same kids around to different schools. If Harvard can bring in more poor kids or more minority kids or what have you, that's just going to be fewer poor kids at other colleges. Now, there may be good reasons to shuffle kids around from school to school, but the problem that I think most people would find the most urgent is to get more kids into college at all who aren't going. And if you want to address that, you have to look at K to 12 academic preparation. Minority students are only about 20% of them are able to meet the minimum qualifications for a four-year college.
And Neil, if this is Virginia Horton again, mm-hmm. if I might say, when we were doing the college tours and we toured at Columbia and NYU and some other very good schools, the rap from the financial aid people was always, we will meet 100% of need for those who qualify.
But
so if you are, and I think what your experts are telling you is that if you are a student with a 1,400 or 1,500 board scores, but you are very poor, your college that you've chosen to go to will strive very hard to meet that need.
Yeah.
I think it's really important to bear in mind the sort of fundamental problem here, and was the very first speaker mentioned it, and that is that only 3% of the freshmen at the 146 most selective colleges come from families in the bottom quartile. The reason there aren't more of those kids going to Columbia is not because they can't afford it, although, of course, they can't afford it. It's because they have never been in a position to apply, much less to get in. And unless we start recognizing that that's where the injustice starts, we're never going to be doing anything more than putting on a little Band-Aid.
Virginia, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's a great, great subject.
Thank you. And I would like to thank both of our guests, Greg Forster, a senior research associate at the Manhattan Institute. He was with us from his office in Florida. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And also to Walter Ben Michaels, the head of the English department at the University of Illinois Chicago. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And we're going to be talking now. Though an overwhelming number of poor 18-year-olds may not be attending college, many are trying to make an uncomfortable transition into university life. Joining us to speak about the experience of poor kids entering universities is Arthur Levine, president of the Teachers College at Columbia University. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Nice to be with you.
So what is it like for a poor kid to walk into college?
It's a profound shock. What happens to many poor kids is that they arrive on campus and find that they dress differently, speak differently, listen to different music, don't even get the jokes that other students are telling, and find problems as large as going to the dining room and not knowing which silverware to use, so that they feel marginalized and not accepted on the campus. At the same time, what happens to them is that there's less and less of a fit for them with their own families because their educational level is so much more different. They don't fit quite with their old friends any longer. So they end up being people who know are in limbo, caught between two worlds, neither of which they fit in.
Just remember speaking with Alfred Lebrano, who I think wrote a book by that title about people in limbo and his growing up in a working-class community, going to, I think, Columbia College and finding himself in exactly that situation. What kind of support structure is there to help students who are in that situation?
There isn't enough. We've created support structures that are based on race. We've created support structures that are based on sexual preference and disabilities. But income isn't one of those areas in which a lot of schools have actually made an effort to help students.
Why not?
You know something? I don't know the answer to that. I think part of it may be that it hasn't been obvious all along, the kinds of problems that kids are facing. This isn't something that students readily speak about. It's something they're embarrassed about most often. And I suspect that's the reason.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Elizabeth, who's with us from Beaufort, North Carolina.
Hi.
Hi.
My point about this was that if you're looking for students to go to college or come from lower income backgrounds, self-esteem is an issue that gets beaten into them over and over again as a poor person growing up in normal K-12 school. If you don't have the same stuff, the materialistic things that other people have, it makes you feel worse about yourself in a way that I think is more true today than it used to be. And a lot of kids can't make the connection that just because they're smart, that's why you should go to college, because you assume that other kids who are more advantaged have something better about themselves that makes it so they're worthy of it, where you're not.
We're talking about the experience of children from poor backgrounds in colleges today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Elizabeth, are you speaking from experience here?
Yeah, I was one of five children growing up in a rural environment in North Carolina. And of us five kids, there was no one before us in any of our families who had gone to college. And yet of us five, three of us managed to get four college degrees. So it can be done, and the financial aid was there, but two of my siblings were, I guess, in some way more beaten down emotionally than the other three of us. And two of us just were really, really smart. And so we were told from the get-go, from kindergarten, that we were probably going to college just because we scored so high. The other one was average, And it took her until she was 35 to go back to school and go to college to get enough self-worth, I think, to believe that she deserved to go.
Arthur Levine, Elizabeth seems to be speaking about what you were writing about.
Elizabeth's story is real typical. I did a study of poor kids who got to college. These were kids who were more likely to end up pregnant, more likely to end up in prison, more likely to meet all the fates that poor kids meet in this country. And I asked them, particularly students who were attending universities like Harvard, I asked, when did you know you were going? And the answer was senior year of high school. And I said, really, you never thought about it before? And they said, oh, wait. Did I mention the program I took in my junior year of high school at Oxford University in England? Oh, wait, did I mention the Upward Bound campus, the Upward Bound program I took on a local campus? Wait. Did I remember to mention the science fair, the debate team, or the kids don't end up, poor kids, at elite universities, much like being discovered in Hollywood at Schwab's. They have long histories of early identification and enrichment programs that lead them there.
Elizabeth, thank you very much for calling.
Thanks.
Let's see if we can
By the way, they have one other thing that's worthy of mention. Every one of the kids I interviewed said, they told the same story, and the story was, there was one person in my life who told me I could do this and helped me get there. Could have been a mother, could have been a father, could have been a sibling, next-door neighbor, or teacher.
Let's talk with Tom, who's with us on the phone from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hi. I guess I have a couple of comments and a question, and my basic question is, since when did going to college become something that was fair? Because right now I'm finding it to be particularly unfair. We have four children. We had a moderate college savings. I admit it was not enough as it should have been. But two of my children are now in college, and to be able to find the money to do this has become extremely difficult. And we are very fortunate that we do have four smart children who will most likely be able to
Tom, we're running out of time, so is that the nut of what your question is?
Another question is yes, why? When did this become fair? When did it become fair to have to have economic diversity when we don't have it anywhere else in society?
Arthur Levine, if you could make a short response.
It never became fair. College never was fair, but beginning right after World War II and into the 60s, we made a commitment as a nation to overcome income differences, race differences, gender differences, and geography. And that's been part of a long national struggle for forever, since the first colleges, financial aid has been intended for those who couldn't afford to go to college. It's only recently that's been changed and applied for merit.
Tom, thanks very much. A good point. We appreciate the phone call. And Arthur Levine, thank you for your time today.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Arthur Levine, president of Teachers College at Columbia University. He was with us on the phone from Los Angeles. When we come back from a short break, we'll delve into what may be the root of all of the seven deadly sins, greed. Our occasional series continues. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.